Welcome back to Following Noah on a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 220, and we are in chapters 3 through 11 of The Sunlit Man by Brandon Sanderson. Paul, how are you?
Wonderful. Excited for another week. We got a tiny glimpse into this book last week. Excited to actually take more of a full bite, you know, full bite out of the story, and definitely some things that I need to talk about with you guys to make sense of.
There are some conspicuous clues dropped on page for us to discuss this episode. Elliot, how are you?
Our listeners, maybe on Spotify or places like that, are not going to see me emphatically nodding my head when Paul says I need to talk about this with others, because this is a dense book in the sense of there are so many little clues and hints and references all over the place. There's no like big thinky sections necessarily. There's a few actually that go a little deeper. You know, there's no big philosophy yet, but so many little bits and pieces that I feel like I can't digest them all. I just have to keep reading and maybe understand it all later, I hope.
Did you guys catch who the acknowledgement was for this book as opposed to the other secret projects? Or the dedication, I should say.
I don't think I did.
I don't think I did either. I probably heard it, but I do not remember.
So the dedication for this book is for all of you, the fans of the Cosmere, who make my dreams come to life. Whereas the other two Cosmere books were specifically for Emily, his wife. So yes, there are plenty of very cool little seeds thrown at you as a Cosmere fan. If you've gotten this far to read Sunlit, I think Sanderson has just decided to go a little crazy with all the things he can throw at you. So, with that in mind, let's roll intro and then get a brief plot summary from Elliot. All right, Elliot, we'll talk about the planet a little bit more once you're done with the summary, but go ahead and summarize just the plot and the setting and the characters. Go for it.
Okay. I'm going to attempt to. As I just mentioned, there's lots of little nuggets and bits of important pieces thrown in. I'm not going to try and touch on all of those. So I'm intentionally going to skip quite a bit and try and just hit the high points to give you some context about the story that we're talking about here, and then we'll get into some of the more details as we go. With that said, we jump in. Nomad is thrown into an arena, and he watches these people that he's encountered, the same ones who were just recently executing people to the Blazing Sun. They chase them around the arena. They catch some of them. They re-imprison a few of them. They take one of them to become an ember person and stab the ember into their chest. Another one gets like consumed by the leader guy who just puts his hands on him and just sucks all the life out of him. Some crazy stuff going on. Nomad doesn't seem all that phased, to be honest. He just kind of is rolling with it and honestly seems more worried about the Night Brigade than he does all of these more dangerous people around him. It's true. But in the midst of this, some apparently rebels kind of break into the scene. They're under attack and these people are jumping out. They end up grabbing a few of the prisoners and running away. They end up taking Nomad with them. He kind of forces them to take them with them. So Nomad is off with these other strange people who have come in. He runs off with them, learns that they are indeed a kind of rebel group who have broken off maybe from these other people, and that they are from Threnody, and learns more about them. They seem a rather religious type of folks. He's learning a little bit more about the planet kind of as he goes. He's soaking in bits and pieces about the world that he is around. He's learning about the power sources that they have. They've got these little ships and hover cycles and cool little stuff that all seem to run off of these little power cores that they've got. He does eventually manage to get enough investiture in him to create a connection to the planet to be able to speak the language. And that doesn't come till chapter 7. So we spend a solid 6 chapters of this book not really getting to learn these characters because Nomad can't speak to any of them. Finally does get that connection, is able to talk with them a little bit. We meet the 3 old women who are the leader of this rebel group, I guess. Their city is called Beacon. And the greater good are these 3 old women who are leading the team. They're just trying to survive. They're hiding in the storm from the Ember people and the scary warlord guy. Nomad is continuously kind of reminiscing about the past. He's trying to stay cynical through a lot of this. He's like, stop trying to care about these people. I just need to get off this planet. But he can't stop thinking back to kind of who he used to be. There's little bits and pieces about that. And then he full on has to confront that when none other than Hoid appears on the city. And we get a whole chapter of Nomad and Hoid having an awesome discussion. And that's kind of about as far as we go with this. Yeah, lots more to learn about the planet. I'm going to go in depth on that in a few minutes. I think that covers the high points of the plot.
Sounds good. Yeah, I think you covered it pretty well. Should we just talk about the world first and then circle back to some of the character stuff? Because there's some interesting tidbits about the planet we're on here.
I do want to force you guys to endure a potentially lengthy explanation about this, because there's a ton going on. One, I want to talk you guys through it, but two, I need to process it with someone. So I did spend probably way more time than I should have drawing up some material for this. If y'all,
that's are why we're here.
I was going to say, this yourselves. Is what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for this moment. I had a good feeling it would come. Elliot always seems to deliver with these. So love.
I almost didn't, because the book honestly does a really good job of spelling it out. The book honestly walks you through it in a really cool way. I'm really enjoying watching Nomad kind of learn about it. But to try and put it all on one page, which for me, I'm a visual person. I love reading books, but I also love when I can see it in either artwork or diagrams or whatever. So I just had to draw it up, had to sketch it up. So Trevor, bring up on the screen here with your editorial magic, the image that I just sent you in the Discord. If you are listening to us on Spotify, you're not watching our YouTube video, I apologize. Now, the next few minutes are not going to make a lot of sense to you. Go back and read the book for the good descriptions, or hop on our YouTube or in our Discord. I'll post this in our Discord as well, so you can follow along with this diagram as I try to talk you guys through this. There's a lot going on here. It's one of my more complicated ones, but bear with me. I'm going to talk you through it. This is my overview of the planet. Canticle is apparently what this place is called.
Canticle.
I don't know why, but for some reason, my brain immediately goes to Canto Bite, the planet from Star Wars, which no similarities at all other than the name starts with Cant.
My brain went to Candle.
Candle. Apparently, a canticle is a word. It's like a religious hymn, is a canticle.
Oh, interesting. My word just, yeah. my brain simply said, this means you can tickle. Like, you have the ability to tickle. That's what I was thinking.
I like that one the best.
Canticle.
Yeah.
I like that one the best. Okay, Canticle. What are we dealing with here? So there's a lot of things going on here, and Nomad is trying to figure out them all. So here are 2 different views of the planet. So my circles here are intended to be, you know, you look into the planet. On the left side, we've got the view down from the top. So the North Pole is like straight in the center there. That's my letter N in the middle. On the right, you're looking at the view kind of from the side of the planet. So the North Pole is at the top of that one. So on the right, you can see that this planet has rings. There's rings around it. That's an important part. They use the rings for light. They get quite a bit of reflected light off of them. And for navigation, you can kind of know where you're at in the planet because of the rings above you, which is important because the ground below you is constantly changing for reasons we're going to talk about here in a second. So you can't just work off of the landmarks around you because the landmarks change every rotation of the planet. So you got to look up to know where you're at. They talk quite a bit in a few different places about corridors. Corridors are your latitudes, essentially. So on the right side of my picture here, you see these horizontal lines. Those are like latitude lines on Earth or any planet. Those are what they're talking about as far as like lanes of travel. So the sun is, you know, obviously blazing one half the planet, right? So these people spend their entire existence running away from the sun, traveling horizontally around this planet, never endingly trying to run away from the sun so you don't get fried. So they're all kind of sitting at a certain latitude, running directly. I was getting my east and west all mixed up when I tried to do this because I think
He specifically says it's backwards. So yes. The sun rises from the west, and so you're running to the east. Yes, it's specifically backwards.
And that bent my brain quite a bit. So my red arrows on this graph here are trying to show you the direction the planet is going, which I think is the opposite of Earth. But it became one of those things I stared at too many times. Now it doesn't make any sense.
Looking at this, I think your red arrow is incorrect on the first side because you've put dawn behind the sun according to your red arrow.
Yeah, so that confuses you a little bit. I think I'm right. I had the first same thought as you. Remember that the planet is what's spinning, not the sun. So the stuff around is not moving. It's the planet that moves.
You're right.
So you, like standing on the planet, right, are going to ride that carousel around. And as you approach the sun, you're in dawn. Yes, in the top left, you're down where the planets are as you spin towards the sun. And so you see it rising on your horizon. So we're kind of in corridors. They're traveling east to west, I think, is how this is going because the sun is chasing them. No, see again, the sun is waiting
west,
for them.
West east. Into.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe.
The sun is rising in the west and you're running to the east. So you've west behind you.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, correct. You're going against the rotation of the planet. So the planet is going to rotate kind of east-west, but you have to travel west to east in these corridors. Yes. See, this is why I had to draw this out, because it breaks your brain to start kind of thinking about this. Okay, so that's the right side. Oh, also quick note, planet spins incredibly quickly. So we're told about galactic standard hours. And apparently, in galactic standard hours, this planet has a 10-hour rotation. And Nomad talks about, that's roughly half of what I'm used to, which would, I think, assuming galactic standard hours matches Earth, would be a bit less than half of what we're used to on Earth.
Yes. Galactic standard hours is supposed to be Earth.
Okay. Now, as if that wasn't complicated enough, now let's go to the left side of what you're looking at here. So on the left side, we're looking down on the planet. And Nomad specifically kind of digests this in chapter eight. In chapter eight, he talks about how he's kind of mentally viewing this planet as having five different phases. So there's five different like zones of this planet, and very specific things are happening in each one of those five zones. So I've divided the planet up into five zones. Now, in reality, I think I've maybe drawn this not quite to proportion, because in reality, the sun should hit like roughly half the planet. So I think the sun zone is actually probably the entire left half of the planet, and the other four divide up the other half. So that maybe would be a little inaccurate here, but you can still get the gist of it. There's five zones here. There's the sun. That one's pretty self-explanatory. We've got this super invested sun that just scorches, melts everything out of existence in that zone. Just apocalypse. Going counterclockwise around, we talked about a second ago, is dawn. So, and that's where Nomad woke up at the beginning. That's where the sun is about to get you. It's coming up over the horizon. And in the dawn section, they talk about how the plants grow ridiculously fast because they're starting to get that sunlight. They're starting to get that huge dose of investiture, which causes plants to grow like to full maturity in 30 minutes or something like that is the gist of this. They go and they plant seeds, go stand and take a water break, and then come back and harvest them. And that's how they get food. There's also,
wouldn't that be nice?
Right? There's also a fascinating bit in here, which I'm still extremely baffled by. There's some artwork. Paul, have you picked up the physical book yet?
Okay, yes, I have. Yes. I have There's... just simply to go look at the art.
This might be slightly beyond the chapters we're talking about for this episode, but I'm going to cheat for a second and talk about it. There's a piece of art that shows them like looking out over the planet, and they see the grass and stuff growing, and there's animals like deer and antelope running around.
Yep.
That breaks my brain a little bit. Like, are the animals being born and living to maturity in that whole time, or do they somehow survive the sun going through, or are they like shepherded running by the people? Do they like drop them off in the grassland for 45 minutes and then come back and pick them up in a little bit? Anyway, all that's happening in Dawn. I think all, if not most, of that's happening in Dawn. Then a little further back on the planet, you get to what he calls the reflected light zone. This one's darker, but this is where like you can see the stars and the light reflects off of the rings. This feels like the most like peaceful part of the planet. This part might be, you know, this might be where you want to live. This is where you'd want to hang out if you could. It's a little quieter.
That's where the Cinder King hangs out. That's where everybody like actually hovers, except for our rebel group.
Yeah. Yep. That's, you don't have the sun like barren over you right over the horizon. You're not in the storm, which we're going to talk about in a second. You're in the nice, happy, reflected light zone. Keep going a little further back and you get the dark cloud zone. So this is not full on storm, but this is like, it's constantly cloud overcome with clouds. Keep going further and you get to what would be like just after sunset. So the sun has just set. If you're there, there's a giant storm permanently going on here. And this is where it's like raining down tons of water all the time. So in the sun zone, it melts the entire surface of the planet, turning all of it into like lava and just raw magma on the surface. But then it rotates into the storm zone and now gets all this water dumped onto it. So you get this, you know, this nice quench of rain on the lava and the magma, which is forming all these crazy geological shapes and mountains and reforming the entire surface of the planet every single rotation. And this is what these people are going through like on a daily basis. That's one day on the planet of Canticle. One more fact before you guys throw questions at me or we spin off in whatever discussion we want to. The planet is tiny. We don't know how tiny yet. I looked for details and they didn't quite have any measurements yet. There's a few questions on it, I think. But the planet is super small, but has a regular-ish gravity because of a super dense core. Nomad at one point talks about it could only be that dense if it's invested somehow. So somehow at the middle of this planet, which is my kind of light blue circle on the left here, there's something in the middle of this planet that is magically over-dense, creating enough mass to create regular-ish gravity on like a moon-sized planet. That is the entirety of what I think is going on here. I want to caveat this super quick with saying I've only read half the book. So there could be stuff coming in the second half, which is going to invalidate stuff that I've put on this diagram. But this is my best guess at what we're dealing with the planet Canticle.
Paul, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Would you rather live here or on Threnody?
Okay, so I think because of how much you'd have to move here, I think I'd choose Threnody. Which is kind of crazy to say, but yeah, I think I'd choose Threnody. I'm like, at least I could find my little, you know, you might have to worry about your home being invaded by the shadows or whatever, but you can at least have a home, I feel like. Here you're just constantly a nomad. So, I think I'd choose Threnody. Side note, by the way, I feel like this is a good time to interject. And it reminded me, because you mentioned canticle. That word means like a hymn, almost like a choral hymn or something. I'm paraphrasing what you said. I learned just from a Google the other day that the word Threnody in the Merriam-Webster dictionary means that a song of lamentation for the deceased, for the dead, which I thought was rather fitting given
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Given the state of things on Threnody, I feel like that's pretty fitting. And also just a really neat little tidbit. I feel like that's maybe why it was chosen, or I have no idea, but I feel like that's not a coincidence. You know, that's really, I think that's really neat. So, and also two like song references with our location titles. So, yeah, awfully interesting.
Okay. I had another question, but I don't remember what it was. Oh, just a one cryptic comment for you. On your lovely visual here that you've created, which is great. You did a great job. I really appreciate when you do these. There is one key thing here that you are incorrect about that I'm not going to tell you.
Mm.
And so you get to try to hypothesize on what is Nomad and by extension you missing.
I already know it. Okay. I definitely know this. Without a shadow of a doubt in my mind, this is Brandon Sanderson's chance to have a non-spherical planet. Ooh. Calling it.
Okay.
Calling it. I don't know what shape it is. No idea. But somehow, maybe it's a cone. I don't know. Somehow, it's not spherical. That's my prediction. That's all.
I do want to say, Trevor, you mentioned the dedication at the book, the beginning of the book. There was actually something in the acknowledgments that caught my eye. I always read those just because it feels wrong to skip over printed words in the book. Normally, it's just him thanking all his readers and his wife and his editor. There's a special thank you in the acknowledgments. I'll just read it. A special thank you goes to Dr. Joseph Jensen for his help with the astrophysics, as this one is a bit of a doozy as far as that is concerned. I read that as like the fifth or sixth sentence into this book and was like, yes, this is going to be a good book.
All right. Let me ask you guys this question. I remembered what my earlier question was. Brandon's got a thing for world building, right? He thinks of worlds all the time. That's part of his podcast is him and Dan Welsh just sit there and talk about crazy world ideas for, you know, half an hour. Has he gone too far? Is the world a little too in your face on this one? Paul, you're muted.
Whoops, you're right. Okay, as wild as this world is, I don't think it's too far at all. I think it's okay. Very far in the this is not too far. However, I will say we've had this discussion with some previous books, with I think all of our secret projects. Is this a place that you, this is a book you would hand to a first-time reader? And that's an overwhelming no for me so far. Overwhelming no. Yeah, no. I'm like, this, I feel like it's probably been very intentional that this is the last book that we're reading. Of the published Cosmere stuff, because there is a lot of things that you just need to know about for this to make sense. You know, like it's not like some, it's like, oh yeah, there's a mention of an ether or a shard, but you don't need to know that for the story going on. And here I'm like, you kind of need to know a lot about investiture, like as a minimum, like you've got to have your prerequisites in order. This book up so far.
That there is a debate on exactly how many prerequisites are for this book. And if there is anything you can skip, let alone. So I think the list of prerequisites is larger than the list of stuff you don't need.
And we even got into this discussion a little bit already in our Discord. The list of prerequisites for this book might include books that aren't released yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's already, I can tell, a healthy debate going on about are there going to be spoilers for things like Wind and Truth in here? At the end of the day, when we have more books than we do now, are we going to recommend things like you have to read all of Stormlight Archive Era 1 before you read this? Maybe.
It's a good question, and one that's been brought up in other circles as well. Have we been spoiled on Wind and Truth? Because not only do we know Sigsel lives through Wind and Truth, which you could argue is a spoiler right there. Two, we get a full Dawn Shard discussion in this episode. in chapter 10 of this book, and you're like, okay, hold the phone, hold on. We'll get there probably towards the end of this episode, but I think we missed the boarding platform of this conversation. I want to go understand exactly what happened, and maybe, and so the kind of frustrating part of this is that a Wind and Truth thing, or is that a Stormlight 10 thing, and we don't know.
I will laugh very hard in 20 years when, after all of Stormlight Era 2 is written, the recommended reading order becomes you read all of Stormlight Era 1 and 2 and then Sunlit Man. And here we are reading it.
We actually had a discussion about this on our Wind and Truth episodes with David and Tim. We were wondering if these events will be shown in Stormlight at all, or if this is just expected that this happens sometime off screen and he's never planning on writing it. This is him writing in like rules about Dawn Shards, and we're just never going to be able to see it.
Honestly, that's been my guess. I feel like, especially in Stormlight 5, I don't expect Dawn Shards to be expanded on, maybe a smidgen, but not like a focal point. This feels like the most like hints we've gotten at so far at Dawn Shards and things. So that was the number one thing that coming into this episode, I wanted to hear what y'all had to say and
well,
share my thoughts. I don't know if that's what we're talking about yet, but
yeah. So the Dawn Shard thing's actually a little bit precarious because we've read for next week, but we can't talk about it because we get some very key information for next week, but we do get it mentioned this week. So, you know, how much we're going to talk about Dawn Shards this week. I don't know.
I do have notes that I wrote from my live reaction on chapter 10, which we can come back to.
So. Okay. Okay. We've talked about the world. Is there anything else world setting that we'd like to cover before we,
I think briefly, let's mention the technology that we're seeing here. Yep. This seems like a very, very technologically advanced, potentially the furthest we've seen yet, I think. I'm almost envisioning it as the time frame, like the potential technology they could have is very far beyond anything we've seen, even in Yumi.
Right.
But they're kind of in a little bit of a state of disarray in their society and their civilization, so they don't have time to be inventing things. They're just trying to stay alive, but the technology they've got is pretty advanced.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that you mentioned Yumi, because without Yumi, I would say absolutely, like, you know, hover bikes and blasters and all sorts of cool stuff, but they're missing some very key fundamentals of like society. They're missing an actual city. They just have kind of a hodgepodge of hover bikes, and that's their town. So I like what you said there. The potential, absolutely. Once they get their ducks in a row on this planet, yeah, they're a player in the Cosmere for sure. That they got to figure out the sun first, though.
So they've got tech. They've got these cities that split apart into pieces, which is really kind of cool. It's almost like everyone owns their own little individual ship, but just in general, they connect them all together, bolt them all together, and form this big conglomeration where each individual ship contributes its own thrusters and the whole city kind of floats, which I realize is probably what's being depicted like on the cover. If you look on the cover, there's these little like floating city little things. That's got to be these floating cities that these people have. But it's also mentioned that there's a bunch of different people groups as well, maybe like a lot, who all have their own individual like city state things that are floating around. So kind of crazy
their own corridors, which we already mentioned this, but I think that's actually really cool that you call the place where you live your corridor, not like your private property, but your private latitude. Or,
well,
would that be a longitude? Longitude.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, actually, because that's the only way for each one of those like country territory lines to include part of all the different phases.
Right.
Like you have to have an entire corridor if you want to be able to have dawn and reflected light and dark clouds, right? If you want farmland, but also safer spaces and water coming from the rain, the storm, you have to have all of that. So you have to have this narrow band. All the countries have to be these like narrow bands along the latitude lines, which is kind of crazy. And then there's a mention in here somewhere about the big bad guy, Cinder King. That is mentioned in chapter 11, Cinder King.
Yeah, Cinder King. Rebecca mentions him by name like right off the bat.
Yeah, we're going to get to that other name here in a second. But Cinder King, he controls the equator, which
yeah.
I had to, real quick on that. Interesting that that's his choice. I think I can see why, because that would be by far the largest country. I'm doing my air quotes over like country. You'd have the most control of space and resources because the equator is going to be the largest corridor by far. Up towards the pole, your corridor is going to be pretty tiny. But there's an interesting fact about the equator. At the equator, that is where the sun is going to move the fastest.
Yeah.
The sun circles the planet in your 10-hour rotation, no matter where you are. So if you're at the equator, the sun, the dawn is going to move way faster than it does at the poles. So you better have pretty good ships if you're going to be at the equator, because you're going to have to move much, much quicker to get away from the sun than you do up towards the poles. So more resources at the equator, but a bit more dangerous as well.
Yep. Same amount of time to cover way more distance.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So I didn't think the name Rebecca was a controversial pronunciation of this word, but when I mentioned this to Elliot earlier, he had no idea who I was talking about. So Elliot, it's spelled Rebecca. I don't know how else you're pronouncing this name.
No. So Nomad makes friends with a local and is spending a lot of time hanging out with her. Her name is obviously Rebecca. It's not that hard. It's just a funky spelling of a very common name. I'm putting like a German E on the end. You ever seen something like those German words that have an E on the end that you kind of like pronounce with that eh? It's just Rebecca. Right? I would go down the path of like Rebeek before I'm about to say Rebecca. So
Rebeke.
Yeah, don't even start me on this Rebecca nonsense. Not buying
it. Actually, according to the audiobook, he does say Rebecca in the audiobook.
She's not. I don't she's know not if from Stell. You don't say every syllable you see or every vowel you see. Because if she was from Stell, I would agree with you that it would be Rebeke or Rebecca or whatever.
I'm gonna plant my stand. I think I'm gonna rebel on this one. I'm gonna call her Rebecca. And I even asked you guys who the audiobook reader was, because if it's not Michael Kramer, then it's not canon. And therefore, this audiobook reader, I apologize to whoever this is and to Brandon. They're just wrong. It is definitely Rebecca. I'm gonna call her that. And you can't stop me.
Fair enough. It would be William Demerit, who is the audiobook reader for this one, which actually in the live stream for this early chapter release, he mentioned that they were beginning to branch out from Michael Kramer and Kate Redding on purpose for Cosmere books, because that they're preparing for Michael Kramer and Kate Redding to retire. So they're exploring other options and getting our spoiled ears attuned to other people who can voice the Cosmere, which I don't know if I'm ready for, but you know. Okay. So the Threnodites, which Sigzil or Nomad actually comes to this conclusion before even talking to them. He listens to their conversation for about 2 pages and then comes to the conclusion, oh, these are Threnodites, because he hears the name Rebecca, which we'll come back to in a second, which doesn't fit here. Divinity, zeal, solemnity, divine, and then there's the head three ladies who are like the compassion.
Good, the greater good, compassion and something else.
Confidence and something. Yeah, anyway. So he talks to Auxiliary, and Auxiliary says, oh, did you catch the names? And so they both come to the conclusion that, they're Threnodites, or they're from Threnody, or at least they were at some point. All right, let's talk about Shadows of Silence in the Forest of Hell for a second, gentlemen. How much do you guys remember that book?
A bit minimally, honestly. I remember the setting. I could kind of picture the world, maybe, but storyline, it's been a minute. It's been a hot minute.
I remember shades everywhere. You have to like be quiet and don't spill blood, or their eyes turn red and they come after you. You need silver to like ward them off.
Yeah.
That's about it.
I feel like these secret projects are Brandon exploring all those cool ideas he had back in Arcanum Unbounded, but not like directly. He's sliding them in Tress and Yumi and Sunlit. Like when I opened this book, was I expecting to need to know about Shadows for Silence and the Forest of Hell? No. But do I need to? Yeah. Like, it's pretty important to know about that short novella that I would guess the casual Cosmere reader has not read those like quick novellas in Arcanum Unbounded, but they seem to be coming more relevant as we go further. So yeah, so we've got a Threnodites. They are on their little guerrilla force rebellion thing and called Beacon, and the main city is called Unity and Beacon. So Beacon is our little rebel ships, and that's kind of where we leave Nomad at the end of this episode. We'll talk about Hoid shows up on Beacon by the end of this episode, so we'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, we've got our ships that are disconnecting, reconnecting, and they talk about some of their economics and stuff like that. So, yeah, anything else? I want to talk about Nomad before we talk about Hoid, because Nomad's going through some stuff. But anything else on Beacon before we talk about Nomad?
We should probably... maybe now's the right time, maybe it's later, to talk about like what they're doing aside from just trying to survive. Part of that raid that I mentioned at the beginning where they grab some people and say, or maybe it's just the one person they grab. It's Rebecca's sister, Elegy, who they save. And they also manage to nab this metal disc. And Nomad takes
metal.
Is it wood?
It's plastic.
Is it?
He specifically says it's plastic because it's not, it can't be metal because Skadrians have a thing for metal. So it's specifically plastic.
Plastic disc. For some reason, it was metal in my head. I think I must have read too fast. I think I read Skadrial and just automatically, oh, it must be metal then. Plastic disc. Nomad takes one look at it and goes, oh, yeah, Skadrians. And so apparently, we're on the hunt for some kind of Skadrian. The Threnodites are hoping it's a bunker that they can hide in.
Well, the Threnodites are hoping it's like a city. They think it's the Sunlit Man like city. But Nomad doesn't think so. Nomad thinks it's a lab that the Skadrians are here set up observing something. Which there's plenty here to observe. So maybe, you know. Yeah, so we've got a Skadrian bunker that I guess is the end goal. But let's slow down and talk about Nomad for a second. When I first picked this book up, I was like, all right, cool. What, we get a glimpse of Sigsil in the future. What's he like? What's he up to? He is deliberately not anything like we see him on Roshar. And it's not that he's, you know, grown a lot as a person, which he has, but he's deliberately put his past self behind him and trying not to be that. Which I thought was interesting. Would you guys... I've kind of have a big... I don't want to say obsession. Fandom for our Bridge 4 gentlemen. So anytime we get to learn about Bridge 4, I'm really excited. So learning that Sigzil is nothing like he was on Roshar kind of hit me pretty hard. I was like, oh, that's unfortunate. Did you guys have any reaction to that at all?
I did a bit. So it's become pretty apparent that this is not the same Sigzil that we see in Bridge 4, right? It's made very clear that obviously a lot has happened. A lot has changed. There's a lot of tidbits in these chapters, especially what I'm thinking of is chapter 10 when Hoid talks about the Dawn Shard, how like Dawn Shard saving the Cosmere. There's a lot of major things mentioned. Yeah. And it's obvious that Sigzil is not playing the same game he is when we see him in his story, you know?
Right.
And so I've had less of the feelings and the desire of what can I learn about Sigzil as the character that I know him as, but trying to piece together what has happened to get us here. You know, I'm sure that's the questions most people have, right?
Yep.
You know, that's the big question. You know, what the heck has happened to get Sigzil here with the Dawn Shard maybe running around? Who knows, you know? So that's what, most of my thoughts have been. There are a lot of nods, right? Like, the way we found out that this is Sigzil is references his old master. Like, there's still obviously things that he remembers keenly and well, but it feels like he is, a sour note for a lot of people, you know, that's not what we're used to. And I take it as fully just fatigue and the struggle of this whole skipping, running from the night... What is it? The Night Order or whatever. Night Brigade. Over and over and over and over. Like, he's just kind of... I almost picture this like how I imagine the Descent of the Heralds may have been. Like,
ooh,
a never-ending trial that is just slowly chipping him down, you know? So...
Before Trevor reads some quotes, because I think he's going to read some quotes...
I am.
A couple of things I've noticed that are sprinkled throughout is, like you just said, Paul, these references to stuff that we can pretty quickly pick up on maybe what he's talking about, but you're right. It comes with this almost sour taste to it. And I can't tell if that's a satirical or sarcastic, affectionate reference. Like one example would be in chapter 6, there's a sequence where he's rising up through the air. And he talks about this clearer air, this breath of fresh insight into what's going on. He's like, oh man, almost like I was air sick. Oh wait, no, that's going way too far. Nope. You know,
yeah.
Clearly a reference to Rock always making fun of all the air sick lowlanders who have too much oxygen in their brains. But I can't tell if he's almost joking with himself, he's affectionately remembering Rock, or if it actually is he's burned his bridges or something terrible has happened and he does not like the memory of these older acquaintances and connections that he had.
Yeah. I won't answer it. Instead, I'll read two quotes that I would like to highlight about kind of where Nomad is mentally. One is in chapter 4, and it picks up with this. The crowd cheered as Glowing Eyes raised the second spear. The poor captive screamed a piteous sound, pulling against his captors. Not my problem, Nomad told himself, closing his eyes. But he could still hear. And somehow, in shutting out the light, there within the blackness of his own design, he felt something. Something of the person he'd once been. Words once spoken in a moment of glorious radiance. Damnation, he thought, as the man's terrified shouts shook him to the core. Nomad forced his eyes open and ripped his right hand out of the manacle, his supernatural strength shattering the thumb and tearing the skin along the sides of his hand. He raised the bleeding hand above his head and to the side, then summoned auxiliary. Holding the hilt with only his fingers against his palm, Nomad whipped his hand forward, throwing auxiliary to spin, flashing and glorious through the air. Huh, auxiliary said in his head. I thought you couldn't do that anymore. He'd intentionally aimed away from glowing eyes as he threw. By not threatening anyone, Nomad could avoid triggering the torment. That said, it had been a while since he'd seen the full blade, been able to access it in all of its glory. As he'd hoped, glowing eyes was stunned by its spectacular apparition. He gaped at the sword in confession. And then another quote in chapter 11, which is where we end the episode. This is Ox speaking first. I remember revelations in light, transformations. Those were rare days, Nomad said, shifting his gun against his shoulder. Most change doesn't happen with a revelation in light, Ox. Most change happens as slow, steady slide toward the pit. Like how we age, step by shuffling step toward the grave. You don't age anymore. My body might not, but my soul sure does. It's been rounding that pit for years, step by step. We wear away. Ideals are like statues in the wind. They seem so permanent, but truth is, erosion happens subtly, constantly. And another quote that I didn't read, but I do want to highlight as I talk about this. Nomad brings up destinations when he talks to Hoid, and he tells Hoid that destinations matter, Hoid, no matter what we say. And Hoid comes back with, well, nobody ever said they weren't important. And then the implication is, you know, people just said that the journey was more important. But anyway, I really like this idea that we have an ex-Knight Radiant, obviously. Maybe current Knight Radiant. We don't really know what's going on with Auxiliary, but there's clearly something going on with Sigzil's oaths. And to see Sigzil live long enough to change as a person to not care about those oaths anymore and to erode those oaths, I think is a really interesting idea. That, yeah, you can swear the fourth ideal when you're young and full of life and willing to protect all of Bridge 4. But what about when you're 375 and Bridge 4 is all dead and those oaths don't mean anything to you anymore? What happens to you?
The more you talk and the more I think about what Paul said a minute ago, the more this is actually becoming really fascinating for me. This is a really cool take on immortality. Paul, you compared it to heralds. We've seen these heralds who, as far as we know, were pretty stand-up folks back in the day. They might have even been the pinnacle of virtue and heroism. And yet we've seen their decline into madness and twisted worldviews over the course of millennia. Here we see Nomad, Sigzil, maybe kind of along that path where he's on that decline. I kind of think about this as a maybe comparison to like Tolkien's works. In Tolkien, right, the elves are immortal, but largely kind of as they go about their immortal lives, their knowledge and their wisdom just increases. The oldest of the elves are the wisest and the most revered. In the Cosmere, is it maybe kind of the opposite? It's maybe immortality does not age well. Maybe the commentary is that humans, we decay and immortality maybe doesn't suit us. And you stay alive long enough and you'll become a madman and forget all the things you stood for. Is that the statement? I'm now thinking these thoughts.
It is interesting, Elliot. I feel like it's definitely not the linear or maybe
sure
logarithmic increase or something that you might see with Tolkien's elves, because that's what I think of also. I think of immortal beings, the wisest, the most gentle, the most understanding, assuming they're a protagonist, I guess. But yeah, and that's been the biggest puzzling thing for me with the Heralds. I was so excited to meet the Heralds originally. If y'all remember when we were just reading The Way of Kings or something, that was my biggest, like my biggest wish. I wanted to meet the Heralds. I wanted that sage wisdom or like, you know, awe-striking power. Like they've honed their, you know, fighting craft or something for thousands of years. And they're just the best, you know, the strongest, most formidable force. And they were just lunatics, you know, like they were just crazy, like, you know. And that was so wild to me, but it definitely makes sense, like given the context. And I think that's perfectly well and good that it's different, you know, than what I'd expect. But yeah, I wonder if that's sort of what we're seeing here. I'm not going to go so far as to say like, yes, this is like Saezul is now fully immortal and this is his slow descent into madness. I don't necessarily think that is the case. However, I do think it is, like obviously we're seeing there's a lot of jadedness towards the what was the great big moments of honor and like the height of the character we know. You know, there's less reverence for the oaths. There's less of reverence for the characters we may know. Like he talks about Hoyt in here too, I believe, and it's not necessarily like, well, I love that guy, you know, like he seems kind of miffed at him. Yeah, absolutely. And he talks about it with like betrayal and things like that. Like there's a lot of hard feelings in it, and it's rather interesting.
We can push this into a conversation about Hoyt as well, because there's this very specific line that I really appreciate it as a reader, because I've been asking the same thing for three Stormlight books now. I've been asking the same question of, okay, if Saezul knew Hoyt and Hoyt knew Saezul, we learned that in The Way of Kings, how have they never had a conversation? How have they never sat down and talked? Why did Hoyt not come and, you know, find Saezul and maybe help him out, or, you know, at least have a conversation with him? And Saezul asked the same question. And I'm like, yes, finally. Because, yeah, Nomad's really upset at Hoyt for saying, don't pretend you care about me. You used me as a tool, which I get. That's fine, whatever. But don't now pretend that you care about me. I lived in the same city as you for years and you never came to talk to me once. So the message that Hoyt or that Saezul has received from Hoyt, either intentionally or unintentionally, we've kind of talked about immortal people can, you know, lose track of time and hurt mortals with like, you know, their actions and stuff. But Hoyt never goes and talks to Saezul. And that hurts Saezul. And so presumably they have this vague Dawn Shard discussion about, I picked up the Dawn Shard because you wanted me to. And Hoyt says, well, you probably saved the Cosmere doing that. And Saezul says, I absolutely did not. Don't pretend that you are the Cosmere, because I saved you. And that is not the same thing as saving the Cosmere. So with all of that, how do you guys feel about this random Dawn Shard mention and then all of the implications that this story has, probably based on that one event?
So this has me questioning Hoyt's, I'm assuming that there's a lot we don't understand here. Our understanding of Hoyt thus far is he's kind of playing a different game. Like, he's involved in all these stories, and he's in the, quote, right place that he's supposed to be, and that he is working to save the Cosmere. Like, he has this grand plan or vision or way to save the Cosmere. It's involving a bunch of moving pieces, whatever. But, you know, hearing Sigsel's account, especially hearing this account from a character that we, like, know and love, it makes me question if he is doing the right or the, you know, a good thing or what the situation is. Why did, you know, is there, you were talking about the conversation. Is it a conversation that Hoid can't have with Nomad for some reason that just isn't told to us? I would hope that's the case if he's not, you know, because I want to root for the guy, of course, but I don't know. It raises questions of that in my mind because we've seen him do a lot of good things, but not like, oh, I'm going to help, like, do this good thing because I want to just help these characters out. It's more of working in his secret master plan or something. And so, yeah, I think I'm questioning a little bit more of Hoid's ethics. I don't know. That's a interesting thing to talk about. But anyways, it just raises some questions for me.
It does seem like we're putting a lot of weight on Hoid being a good guy. To put that in the simplest of possible terms, do we trust Hoid that all of his actions are going to be for the greater good? Because it definitely seems like Nomad doesn't see that right now. He sees that I was used and that I was the collateral damage, even if we saved the Cosmere or a lot of people. It seems to revolve around this Dawn Shard, but I think we're still left with questions of what exactly happened.
Sigsel does mention that because of the torment, he can now use pretty much any type of investiture, which I thought was interesting. So in this episode, he draws out investiture from a speeder, like one of the hover bikes. And I was like, okay, so, you know, like Stormlight, that makes sense. But then it came to that line, and I was like, okay, so is that then unique to Nomad? Can only Nomad use investiture like that? Or could anyone, if they knew what they were doing, inhale the speeder bike core like Stormlight?
Yeah, I was thinking of this too. In my head, it shouldn't be that crazy or hard of a thing to do. In my head, a lot of our world hoppers should be able to just use the investiture, but I think I'm wrong.
I think there's a specific word that we've learned a fair bit about recently, and that's connection.
Yeah.
There's rules. You've got to have the right connections between yourself and either planets or shards or maybe both or whatever, potentially to be able to use the investiture. So it seems like Nomad has gotten some sort of state where he's got it all. But I would think for your run-of-the-mill world hopper, it's an initial question of can you manipulate your connections properly, and then you should be able to use various forms of investiture, I would think.
Right. Because Nomad specifically draws the investiture and then manipulates his connection because he needs the investiture to manipulate. So I wonder if that is unique to him and you would just need a connection to start with for everybody else.
But there's another interesting comment there and about things that are unique to him. He brings this up a couple of times. This fact that seems unique to him, that he can metabolize investiture. And I had to think about that for a while and actually hear him bring it up a couple of times to realize exactly what he was talking about. Because when he said it the first time, I was like, metabolize investiture. Oh, okay, like Lyft. And then I kept reading a little later and was like, oh, hold on a second. No. I think it might actually be the opposite of Lyft. Lyft eats food and can turn that into investiture.
Correct.
Nomad eats investiture and turns it into food.
Correct.
He can sustain his body like metabolically. No, maybe there's a word there. He can sustain his body on investiture alone. So as long as he's got his investiture, he doesn't need to eat or breathe. Apparently that comes up a couple times.
Yep.
Once again, this is why I don't think I could ever hand this to a first time reader. You know, there's a lot of stuff that they'd be like, he can, what? The light makes him, gives him air and food. Like, you know, it's a bit far-fetched. You don't know the rules.
And that actually made me want to ask you guys that question. Zooming out just a second from this book, how do you guys feel about needing to know all that? Like, this is a very term intense book. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's an awesome thing. As long as it remains a standalone book in some senses. Sure. If Sunlit Man can remain at least slightly optional of a read, or in the case of maybe someone doesn't care too much about the nuances of the science behind the Cosmere, but just kind of wants to read the stories, if they can flip through Sunlit Man and not worry too much about reading the details, and they're not going to miss out on something like foundational fact about the Cosmere, then good. However, if there are like events at the end of this book that are going to be pivotal for the Cosmere going forward, maybe that could be a problem, in that there might be some readers who kind of get to this point, then get turned off by Sunlit Man because they're like, this is just way too technical, I can't do this. And then they don't pick up the rest of the Cosmere because of it.
It's well put. Do you get overwhelmed by it, Paul?
Honestly, a bit. I don't think it's... I've wrestled with this. This may be my number one question about the book, or maybe not even a question. Like for me internally, what I'm considering the most, like, it is a lot. And right now, I don't have a crazy investment into the actual plot at hand. I understand he's trying to reach his skip capacity. I'm assuming that's like the primary thing, but it feels like a big tangent of seeing a bunch of stuff, learning a bunch of stuff, a glimpse into the future of the Cosmere maybe, and things like that. But yeah, honestly, so far it's felt like it's a bit much, but that doesn't mean it's not neat. And it's such a like unique experience to get to read it with a lot of understanding that we've had from the previous books. So I have mixed feelings on this. I think this may remain to be determined as we continue reading.
I like what you said there. And I remember you having issues with Rhythm of War. And we spent an entire part talking about siphoning void light out of a sphere. We spent like 20 chapters talking about that. I like it more here than in Rhythm of War, because this book is so unique. And Elliot, the point you brought up, as long as this remains optional, which I won't confirm or deny at this point, as long as this is for the Cosmere fan who's read everything, who goes to the signings, who you know is involved, as long as this is for them and not required reading, and you know, all that said, I like it more here because it's this involved and it's unique. In Rhythm of War, I agree with you, Paul, that Rhythm of War is too much, even though it's less than Sunlit Man. Even though it's less than Sunlit Man, because it's in a main series, there's plenty of casual Stormlight fans who read Rhythm of War and was like, what was that? I feel like I picked up a different book from the first three.
Antimatter and all that.
Yeah. We're talking about anti-void light. Like, what does that even mean? I liked my swords and horses. Where'd those go? You're once again muted, Paul.
Absolutely. You make a really good point, Trevor, that this is the place for it. This is the place to, I feel like we're on the playground. This is the place to let your ideas run wild, run free, reference all the things, do all the stuff. And I think that's great. You make a really great point. I forgot about that being that was probably my number one critique of Rhythm of War. It felt like a big lesson on investiture, on mechanics or whatever, all sorts of stuff. And I was like, you know, where's the stabby stabby part or whatever?
Right. Like we have Ardents making nuclear bombs in the basement. Why are we talking about this?
Yeah. I didn't know this was Oppenheimer and Stormlight together, you know?
Right. All right. Anything else before we close the episode?
I don't think so. Tons of little questions and references, things in Nomad's just thoughts or in his conversation with Hoyd that seem to reference events that we haven't seen. So again, we're getting handed individual puzzle pieces with no indication of what the puzzle is actually supposed to be. So they don't really mean much now. I'm actually wondering if to really get as much as we could get out of this, it's going to require a reread. Like, we just finished Tress. I don't really have any intentions of rereading Tress in the future. I might, for fun, when I'm maybe rereading the whole Cosmere or go through it. But there was nothing I passed by and I was like, ooh, I'm going to need to come back and reread this. There is a lot that we're passing over that I'm thinking, ooh, I might have to come reread this, because there's all these little mentions and references to stuff that I don't understand. Probably gonna have to come back and mine all that stuff later, I guess.
Let me share this with you as we close the episode. You are 3 episodes from being Cosmere current. So plenty of the questions that you guys are asking or noticing, all these random one-liners, are current Cosmere questions, are Brandon Sanderson signing questions that plenty of people are asking. So let's go ahead and close it there. We will reconvene next week with 12 through 25 of Sunlit Man. Thanks for joining me, Paul Adelman.
On we go.
Up we go.